Hello and welcome to the history of Bangalore. I am your host, Ramji Chandran. And today, we ask the rather simple question, how did we come to discover the early history of Bangalore and who did it? So sit back and I'll tell you what I found out. But before I do, I would like to thank the Prestige Group whose support makes the history of Bangalore possible. Building cities one landmark at a time, they transform dreams into reality. You can be a part of the future. Simply add prestige to your lives. And now, let's dive right in to our episode, Finding Bangalore, the Early History. Quite a few people believe that the history of Bangalore begins in 1537, when Kempe Gowda I built the city. And they would not be wrong. But you know that old anonymous cliche, Rome was not built in a day. Well, neither was Bangalore. So attributing Bangalore solely to Kempe Gowda, or thinking that he hacked this place out of nothing, is to overlook everything that went before him. So the question, what went before him? Well, there's plenty of evidence of a lot of settlements, of trade, of commerce, of agriculture, of water management systems, something that we have managed to destroy in recent times, of military campaigns, and lots of religion, and everything else that the previous generations and dynasties had been up to. It appears that life had been pretty busy around here. But the problem for historians is that while there are verifiable written records of events in the later centuries, the early days of Bangalore, this region, have been hard to decipher because almost all the recorded evidence of our early history is from a single source, inscriptions, carved on stones and to a lesser extent on copper plates. There are thousands of these stones scattered all over the region. These were the gazettes of the day on which record keepers carved matters of public interest like land grants, temple grants, royal edicts and records of public works. And then there are the hero stones, so-called because they recorded the deaths of people who had given up their lives for a cause. Causes that ranged from battles and wars defending the land or mortal fights with cattle thieves. And some stones commemorate those who had taken their own lives by traditions that were considered honorable in its time. The history from these stones or these inscriptions is called epigraphical evidence. These stones have been around for centuries, but in all this time, no one really looked at them altogether. And so the bigger picture, the whole story that is, did not emerge, and we really got no sense of history from them. Instead, our history has been oral history, stories that were told by professional storytellers or sung by wandering minstrels. But without a written verifiable source, it is hard to know how much of this narrative, spoken or sung, could be taken as the truth or dismissed as entertainment or folklore. So what do these inscription stones look like? Flat, reasonably sized slabs of stone, common stone slabs that we might encounter anywhere, upon which people have carved text and pictures. But how much information could we have got from one stone upon which one person with a hammer and chisel had carved out an inscription? In the hands of competent historians, quite a lot. Let me give you an example of how they squeeze history from an old stone. I will read the translation of one of the inscription stones originally carved in Hale Kannada or Old Kannada. I picked this particular stone also because it bears a trenchant commentary on the present day mismanagement of our water resources. Anyway, here's what it says. Be it well. In the victorious year of the rule of Satyavakya Perumidi, in the time of the Kali Yuga, Nagattara, the Irvuliya Rodeya, Irugamaya San Chirimaya fixed sluices to the two tanks, had a third in eastern tank built, and obtained the Bittuvatta of the three tanks. That is it. That's what the inscription says. So what can we get from this? Let me break it down for you. First, the reference to Satyavakya Perumidi. Now we know that he was a king of the Ganga dynasty in the 9th century. Next, Nagattara. Now he is referred to as the Irvuliya Rodeya. Now, Irvuliyar will be known to present-day Bangaloreans as Ibbalur, a neighborhood in Bangalore, on the Sarjapur Road at Belandur Lake. And Oreya is a chieftain. It's pretty much the same as Wadiyar. Now with all this, historians can place the age of the stone at around 870 AD and place the location of the stone at Belandur Lake. And Nagatara was a big deal and an important figure in our story. He will reappear in future episodes of this podcast. And now, what did the stone say? At one level, the inscription says that they installed sluices on two tanks and then built a third one. Sluices are gates used to control the flow of water. But the real story that we glean from behind this story is that it tells us that even back in the 9th century, they knew the importance of managing water resources. With Bangalore not near a major river source, they built rainwater catchment systems in the form of tanks or lakes, and then connected them up to accommodate overflows and probably using the stored water for irrigation and for human use, like cooking and personal hygiene. And finally, the land grant, or in this case, the rights to manage these three bodies of water. This gives us a window into the economic structure of the day, probably allowing the provincial chieftain a certain revenue source through some form of taxation. Consider this, so much history from one short inscription. And it is in this way that each inscription stone has added another sentence, another paragraph, another chapter to the early history of Bangalore. While we may not have initially learned anything of our history from these stones, it did happen one day. And who did it? The credit for this goes largely to a gentleman called Benjamin Lewis Rice, B.L. Rice, a scholar of South Indian languages, including Kannada and Tamil, and also Persian and Urdu. And the story of Rice and the inscriptions starts in the 19th century. It was 1865, right in the peak of direct British rule over the Kingdom of Mysore. In Bangalore, serving in the 22nd Regiment of the Native Madras Infantry was Major Henry Dixon. B.L. Rice described Dixon as someone skilled in the new art of photography. Dixon had been tasked by then Chief Commissioner of Mysore, L.B. Bowring, to take photographs of the many inscriptions, stones and copper plates that lay around the country. Dixon managed to take 150 photographs, 129 from stones and 21 from plates. But without translation, these photographs remained essentially indecipherable curiosities. Local officials did their best to figure out these stones, but they failed. So Bowring turned to Rice and got him involved. And this event marked the beginning of how B.L. Rice started to translate the inscriptions and started to record for all of us the history of early Bangalore. Now, B.L. Rice seemed underwhelmed by photography in general, which he termed an imperfect art, and especially by Dixon's photographs. And I quote from one of his books. These were taken on a scale so reduced that they could only be read with a magnifying glass, and even so, owing to insufficient cleansing and preparations of the originals, with difficulty. The photographs, however, were eventually, after other efforts to deal with them, placed in my hands for decipherment of the ancient characters and for translation in such leisure time as could be found from my regular duties. My only qualifications for the work were a knowledge of the language and the country. Now, I have read a few romantic accounts of how Rice became so enamored of Henry Dixon's photographs that it changed the course of his career and plunged him into a study of these inscriptions, and that's all he could do. But all his writing suggests that he was really not that impressed. It seemed like Rice was a bit of a cantankerous guy and a somewhat self-referential man. And this is not to take away from the fact that his work output was prodigious and his writing prolific. And we do owe the discovery of our history to him. But some of his pronouncements were quite funny. Funny grumpy, if you like. For example, speaking of the failed attempts before they brought him Dixon's photographs, he wrote, "Some native officials here, with the aid of pundits, attempted the translation of a few for Mr. Bowring, but as might be expected, with very imperfect results." I wonder what the pundits would make of Rice suggesting, "What do you expect from these native pundits?" Anyway, the way I look at it, Rice is more than entitled to his claim of having grandfathered the history of this land, and it is not for nothing that he earned the title of Shasana Pitamaha, the grand old man of administration, and Puratattva Pitamaha, the grand old man of history. Now, Rice started work on these inscriptions around 1874, when he would have been around 40 years old, and published over 9,000 of them in 12 volumes of Epigraphia Carnatica, a mammoth record of the lives of the ancestry of the present-day citizen of Bangalore. And by the time he was done at retirement in 1906, he would have been just under 70 years old. Rice spent several months a year on the road across the kingdom on horseback, hunting down and transcribing these stones and earning his reputation for a spirit of dedication and dogged determination, deservedly. But also what needs to be recognized and acknowledged is the hand of the British administration in all this. The British Crown took charge of the Mysore Kingdom in 1800 after the fall of Tipu Sultan in 1799 and exercised control or undue influence over the kingdom in one form or another all the way to independence in 1947. The good that came from this was that having taken control, they introduced the practices and procedures and standards by which we understand civil administration today. Proper record keeping is one of those things, and therefore the recording of history became a matter of practice and not royal whimsy. A structured and process-driven environment also meant that educated and trained bureaucrats, both Indian and British, could now just do their job. And one such administrator was a dynamic and far-sighted Diwan or Prime Minister, Seshadri Iyer, to whom there's a statue in Cubbon Park. Among the many things that Iyer did for the Mysore Kingdom, he encouraged the setting up of the Mysore Archaeological Department in 1884 and appointed as its first head Benjamin Lewis Rice, whom Seshadri Iyer knew to be an educator, already an epigraphist and Kannada scholar. And with this, everything became official and Rice was able officially to create the Epigraphia Carnatica. Now, to be fair, Rice's efforts were not really the first at recording inscriptions. In fact, Rice acknowledges the efforts of Chikkadevaraja Vadeyar, who reigned until 1704, who had also started a project to gather the information on these inscriptions in his land, although Rice says that he wanted them not as history for history's sake, but to keep tabs on endowments and land grants. According to Rice again, Chikkadevaraja did manage a reasonable database, but one day in later years, uncaring soldiers under Tipu Sultan's command decided to use all of these library records as fuel for fire to boil food for the horses. Now, the way Rice phrased it in his book might lead people to conclude that Tipu personally ordered this travesty of burning things in the library, but there are no reliable sources that provide attribution for this tale. And besides, there's little other evidence from history to suggest that Tipu went around the kingdom destroying historical records. There is a discernible tenor to some of Rice's prose and that of Bowring that could be interpreted as religious bias. The allegation that Tipu destroyed library records and ordered them to be burnt as fuel is a bit like what happened in Afghanistan, where the Buddhas of Bamiyan were deliberately destroyed by rogue soldiers who fired on these statues with heavy artillery guns and reduced them to rubble. Western press reports suggested that it was a policy decision by the Taliban administration. But today, Taliban forces have been assigned to take tourists to the location where the Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed during earlier Taliban rule. There are videos of Taliban officials shamefacedly admitting that their former colleagues had committed a mistake. And as for tales of them being against idols and idolatry, there is another video that shows the replacement of the statues with eerie, though impressive, holographic statues of the Bamiyan Buddhas in the place of the original. Anyway, while Rice may not have been the first to try his hand at an epigraphical account, he was certainly the more successful. If not for the work of Rice and his immediate successor, Ard Narasimha Char, and the few that went after him, the history of Bangalore would have been lost, neglected through apathy, like so much of the heritage of Indian history. Happily though, that is conjecture, and through Epigraphia Carnatica, we have learned so much about our heritage and the history of early Bangalore. In the next few episodes, we will dive deeper into the early history of Bangalore, exploring inscriptions, tales of battle, victories, and the intricate dance of civilizations upon this land. Now joining me are three wonderful guests, the celebrated Dr. Chiranjeev Singh, who once had Rice's old job, Richard Rice, B.L. Rice's great-great-grandson, who joins me from his home in the UK, and Rupa Pai, well-established author and who writes a regular column on Bangalore history. Stay tuned, I'll be back right after this.
Prestige Group brings to you its latest launch, Prestige Somerville. Lake-facing 3 and 4 bed apartments on Marathahalli, Whitefield Road. For more details, call 85489-85489. Project is RERA approved.
My first guest today has been described as a Renaissance man because he's a scholar, a linguist, and a person who is deeply literary. This romantic side found its way into his job as a senior functionary of the Indian Administrative Service. Once, when a previous boss suggested that he should obey orders unquestioningly, he replied, "Well, the last guy to have done that is in Spandau." I feel privileged to have him here. Dr. Chiranjeev Singh, welcome to the History of Bangalore. And straight to my first question, did you once not have B.L. Rice's old job?
Yes. Though I don't say I am qualified for that, or rather I was qualified for that, but the government posted me.
Well, if it's any consolation, B.L. Rice said exactly that. Dr. Singh, I have been speaking about history coming from epigraphical sources, but there is another source that we know very little about, and this is the literature of the land, something with which you are intimately familiar. But to my mind, literature is literature and couldn't count as verifiable historical record. Could you speak to this? But to begin with, who were the writers?
The great writers of Karnataka, they were Jains initially, all the major writers, Pampa, Ranna, Janna, Lakshmisha, etc. Then, of course, the archaeological evidence, for example, the Buddhist remains at Sanathi, it was a different form of expressing that. The kind of history that we understand is basically a Western. Our history is whatever has been recorded in our literature.
These are two very different forms of recording history. The Western method is much more linear and fact-based, isn't it? And literature doesn't have to be. So how far apart are these two methods?
Well, our method of recording history was more imaginative. The Western is linear. It's more poetical. That's more prosaic. The difference between our way of looking at things and their way of looking at things is the difference between poetry and prose.
And that brings me to another middle ground, Dr. Singh. The business of debates, Indian folklore and mythology has been full of humor and snarkiness and debates and disagreements. Don't see much of that lately, do we?
We are losing that. We are losing sense of humor. We are losing this sense of questions.
For that reason, at least, I submit that some sense of linearity is not entirely unwarranted. Yes.
No, I understand. I'm all the same. I'm just pointing out that, of course, history needs to be written, but it's not just epigraphs and archaeological and numismatic. This thing, the whole literary and oral evidence is also there.
Entirely, I agree. But before I let you go, could you give me an example of that?
For example, this beautiful poem by Kanakadasa, the debate between rice and ragi, it tells you so much about the culture of that time. And that picture you don't get in the inscriptions or copper plates.
And thus the history grows more fascinating. And now for my next guest. When I was researching B.L. Rice, I thought to myself that surely his descendants must live somewhere. And sure enough, to find them was easier than I thought it would be. So joining me now from his home in the UK is the great-great-grandson of B.L. Rice, Richard. Richard Rice, welcome to the show.
Pleasure. Thanks for getting in touch.
So you're a descendant of B.L. Rice, and B.L. Rice means everything to Bangalore history in a way that was meaningful. Did you know this? And how much did you know of his life in India?
Well, yeah, it's a funny story, but I think the answer is not that much, really, considering how you view him and how you have introduced him there. Mm-hmm. I don't think we really did understand quite the significance that he's had. But let me tell you how I found out mm-hmm. about it. My dad knew there was some family history in India, mm-hmm. and his parents had seen some of the history stuff in the 70s, but he never really sort of, well, he didn't communicate to me anyway, or hadn't really understood perhaps the whole significance of it. I think that's the truth of it. So I'm in the travel industry, mm-hmm. and I was kind of curious about this, and I happened to be going to a conference in Kerala for the uh-huh. travel industry, completely unrelated. Mm-hmm. But I said to my parents, look, why don't you come along too? And after the conference, we'll go to Bangalore and have a dig around, just spend mm-hmm. for a few days and see what we can come up with. My dad had been in touch with a guy called Dr. Murthy. I don't know mm-hmm. if you know Dr. Murthy. He was written a PhD thesis, I think, about mm-hmm. B.L. Rice. Mm-hmm. And we arranged to meet him. And so, sure enough, my parents came to the conference. We went to Bangalore afterwards, and we started doing a little bit of a tour of the family sites, as it were. We went to Rice Memorial Church. I think that's on, is it Avenue Road in the yeah. center of town?
Right, in the old city.
Yeah. And we did a few other, you know, sort of trips around, saw BL's house, Penru. Mm-hmm. And then it was sort of strange. We went to see, now I might be getting the pronunciation wrong, but we went to Chitradurga. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Mm-hmm. To the north.
Yes, that's good.
And we went on a lovely walk around, and we were sort of, you know, observing the sites, and possibly we had someone with us explaining it all. And I think that is a site where BL was very active. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyway, we walked down, the sun was setting, it was beautiful. We came back to the car park, and suddenly there were a small crowd of people, and someone popped up with a TV camera and started asking my dad these questions. And we were like, what is going on here? And then it was sort of explained to us that, you know, we were, you know, the Rice family returns kind of story. Right. And it got completely out of hand. And over the next couple of days, we ended up on stage in the in the archaeology department in Mysore stage,
wow.
giving a presentation about the Rices. And what's, you know, as I've mentioned to you before we started, you know more about this than I do. You know more about the Rice family. And everybody in this audience in the University of Mysore, they definitely knew more about B.L.
Right.
Rice than we did. So it was just a very funny situation where we were being asked all these questions, and actually we didn't really have all the answers. So, yeah, it was just a very funny way in which the sort of significance of B.L. was revealed to us.
You know, this is funny. And B.L. was born in Bangalore.
Yes.
And he married Reverend Garrett's daughter. She would be your great, great grandmother.
Yeah.
Now, Garrett owned 450 acres, which became the Bangalore Palace. And it's a big wonder how he afforded that.
Right, yeah. No, he was a property guy as well.
Was he?
He did a lot of property stuff, is that right? Yeah.
I don't know. I really haven't looked into it.
But he had some overlapping interests with BL, is that right? There was sort of, they were sort of, you know, similarly interested in things, I think.
Oh, yes, totally. Yeah. I mean, both were scholars of Indian languages, and
yeah.
And B.L. Rice took Garrett's old job as the school principal and later college principal.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the whole father-in-law, son-in-law dynamic.
Yeah.
Well, here we are, and I'm sure that you were happy to find out what your great-great-grandfather was.
Yeah, it's an amazing history, and what we're always amazed at is just the sheer dedication and energy and commitment that he had to doing this project, all his projects. He had a lot. I mean, you know, that's what stands out to us looking back on it now. And you think, how much work and effort he put into doing it and how consistently he pursued it. It's just absolutely incredible.
That is so true. It was great meeting you, Richard, and thank you for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for getting in touch. Nice talking to you.
And my next guest today is Rupa Pai. She is a chronicler of the city, runs a column in a major national newspaper, and she has authored this rather wonderful book about Cubbon Park, Bangalore's principal lung space. Recently, Rupa wrote a rather evocative column about Benjamin Holt Rice, his son, Benjamin Lewis Rice, and B.L. Rice's father-in-law, Reverend John Garrett. I'm happy to have Rupa here on the show. Now, Rupa, Benjamin Lewis Rice was born in Bangalore.
Yes.
He was a Kannada scholar, so shouldn't we just make him a Kannadiga?
Totally. Yeah, we would love to appropriate him, yes.
Much has been written about B.L. Rice and his work and his accomplishments, and you are as well informed as any other person. But there's one thing that you wrote in your column that has not been picked up by anybody else, and this is about his romance with the daughter of a rival mission. So let's talk about that.
John Garrett, now, why did I talk about John Garrett at all? Because he had started this Bangalore High School, which became the Central College, and he was the first principal of it. But when B.L. Rice came back, he was very happy to hand over to him. He was most capable, put him in charge of Central College. And by, B.L. Rice grew beyond Central College, became sort of the director of education of the Mysore Kingdom.
Right, but in his personal life, given John Garrett, his inheritance was somewhat secure, wasn't it?
In a sense.
Should I describe Garrett as the Ragi to Benjamin's Rice?
Okay, sure, go ahead. That's a nice way to think of it, yes.
Oh, all this romance in the air, what does he do? So Garrett, he goes and sells his putative palace to the king. Mm-hmm. There must have been a fair bit of cheddar on it, correct?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that it's a completely reasonable plan for Rice to have married Garrett's daughter.
Well, I'd like to...
I know you'd like to have a more romantic view of this.
I think I'll give Rice the benefit of the doubt. I think he was actually enamored of Sophia, Mary Sophia.
Of course, I'm just kidding.
And I think they might have been playmates, or they might have known each other in their childhood and youth as well, because she also grew up in the Peta.
Yes, that's right.
But as the child of a rival, the daughter of the pastor or a missionary of a rival mission, the London Missionary Society. So John Garrett and Reverend Rice, who was B.L. Rice's dad, were of competing missions, actually, but both operated within the Peta.
Now, you had a rather interesting analogy for that romance.
Yeah, it was like I like to think of it as a Capulet-Montague intrigue in the heart of Bangalore.
Much better ending than the original, though.
They went on to lead very productive lives, I think, and I hope they were very happy.
Yes, by all evidence and all that. Rupa, could you close us out by reading from the last paragraph of your column?
Yeah.
You talk about what you just said.
The second principal of Bangalore High School, which would go on to become Central College, was 23-year-old Benjamin Lewis Rice, who would woo and marry Garrett's daughter, Mary Sophia. B.L. Rice himself would go on to research and translate thousands of ancient Kannada inscriptions and be hailed as the father of Kannada epigraphy. And in Kannada, he's called Shasana Pitamaha, and Mysore's first archaeologist. Incidentally, B.L. Rice was the son of Reverend Rice, who served a rival mission from Garrett's called the London Missionary Society. So a proper Capulet-Montague story in the heart of Bengaluru Pete.
Now, although you're a chronicler of the city of Bangalore, I managed to get you down here and turn you into a romance novelist.
Okay.
But I'd love for you to be my guest on future episodes.
I'd love to be here. Thank you.
And that is how we came to discover the early history of Bangalore. On the next episode, the battle for Bengaluru and the 8th century stone that changed so much about what we know of the city. I am Ramji Chandran, and this is the History of Bangalore.